This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Movies on the Radio. This month's theme was sequels, and you chimed in with your picks for the best or the worst film follow-ups.
Luke Skywalker and Han Solo rescued the princess, destroyed the Death Star, but their story didn't end there. A big, new, sprawling space adventure in the Star Wars saga, The Empire Strikes Back. Coming to your galaxy next summer.
That's it. Let it all out. I'm here with film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. Marcia, film professor at NC State University and a public scholar at the National Endowment for the Humanities. Laura is the film curator with the North Carolina Museum of Art and curator of the Movie Diva series at the Carolina Theater in Durham. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this because we're talking about sequels, but there's really two kinds, Marcia. Let me start with you. I mean, there's the episodic, right? In other words, it's a continuing series. You don't know how it's going to end unless you see number three and number four. And then there are those franchises that, you know, if number one was good, let's keep trotting out this set of characters and the name to, you know, see how many times we can sell tickets. Two different kinds of sequels, I guess we're talking about here.
Well, actually, there's more than that. There's trilogies, there's sagas, there's reboots. I mean, if you really think about this in the most inclusive sense, and obviously the idea is both to give more space to a story that requires more space, right? So if you have something like The Godfather, which kind of could not be done in a two-hour film, well, the only way to tell the whole story is to continue it. And the other idea is, of course, to exploit an economically successful film. So this one did well. Let's try to do better with the next time. And sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't.
Laura, it is interesting to think about a hybrid format that HBO has pioneered, somewhere between a TV serial and a film franchise. Let's say compared to a movie trilogy, we get a lot more time with the characters, of course, over whatever 10-hour-long episodes. But how do you feel about that format? Do we lose something in that format? Is it too spread out? I mean, how's that working, do you think?
Well, I mean, when movies did series, which, you know, they did, you know, Abbott and Costello or The Bowery Boys or Westerns or, you know, Ma and Pa Kettle. It was just to tell other stories with stock characters. It wasn't to expand their universe or to recreate any kind of character development. I mean, there's no homoerotic Abbott and Costello fan fiction. I mean, nobody was going in that direction.
Not yet.
Not yet, but there might be now.
You may have just spawned a channel, but go ahead.
But television is really invested in bonding you with characters and having character development arc over a story that then you'll invest in season after season because of your love for these particular characters.
Well, let's get to our listeners. This one, a pioneering example of a successful sequel from 1935. Director James Whale flips the script on the original blockbuster.
Hi, my name is Austin Simons, and I'm calling in from Raleigh, North Carolina. One of the greatest things about The Bride of Frankenstein is how it focuses more on the monster instead of Dr. Frankenstein. When I first watched Frankenstein, the original one, I didn't really know what it was about, and so I was expecting it to be focused on the monster. So I was really pleasantly surprised, though, when I watched Bride of Frankenstein, and I saw that it was focused on the monster, and it really got into the monster's head and allowed the viewer to have empathy for the monster and the situation that he was forced into by Dr. Frankenstein.
It is bad to be alone.
Alone. Bad. Friend. Good. Friend.
Now come here. There is good and there is bad.
Good. Bad. Good.
music.
Really, I think the most unique thing about it, though, is that it's better than the original one. That's rare to find with sequels, but Bride of Frankenstein certainly does it, and I think it does it well.
All right, that is about the 1935 sequel to Boris Karloff's debut as Dr. Frankenstein's monster. Marcia, was this considered pioneering?
Yeah, I mean, there are other precedents. So before that, there was the Fritz Lang Dr. Mabuse sequels, and those continued, actually, I've just found out, into the present day. People are still making Dr. Mabuse films. But yes, this is a very early example, and it's a great one because it really is continuing the story. So one of the things that Bride of Frankenstein has to do in the beginning is set up that the creature did not die in the fire at the end of the first one. So it really is taking that moment and continuing it forward into the future. And even though Elsa Lanchester's on-screen performance really only happens at the very end of the film, she's so extraordinary. She's such an interesting character. So it really contributed to the arc of the story.
So interestingly enough, though, here's where the novel actually did more than what the first film could do, because the novel very much gave us an insight into the monster's character and wishes and aspirations by putting that novel in three voices. She was well ahead of her time as a novelist, certainly, and apparently something that the first film couldn't do. So we had to wait for the sequel to get the monster's point of view.
Well, Universal was completely shocked at how well Frankenstein did, that it was the number one box office film of 1930. And they had completely underestimated the appeal of the monster. They didn't even invite Boris Karloff to the premiere. So then they actually went back to the novel, where Frankenstein's creation is extremely verbal and has a deep emotional life, and tried to actually pay better homage to the novel than they had in the original film.
And let me also just add that there are all these wonderful spin-offs. This is such a great concept that Mary Shelley had, and then, you know, obviously Universal tapped into that. There is Son of Frankenstein, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, I Was a Teenage Frankenstein. It goes on and on, so it's such a generative idea. The
Young
character.
Frankenstein. Don't forget that one.
Don't forget it. Say it right, though.
Frankenstein. It was Frankenstein. I'm sorry. No, it's true. And it goes back to that novel, which we're not talking about here, and the generative power of that book to continue to captivate us and hold our imaginations. Well, let's talk about a different listener and a different movie just last year. This is another movie that used a perspective switch to reboot a creepy classic.
Hi, my name is Nick Knittle. I'm calling in from Durham, North Carolina, to talk about Dr. Sleep, the sequel to Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, and also Stephen King's book, The Shining. Stanley Kubrick's The Shining obviously has a monumental place in film and just pop culture in general. So any kind of sequel to a movie like that or a piece of culture like that has a lot of work that needs to be done. But Dr. Sleep handles so many of the themes and legacies of the movie in a lot of new and interesting ways. One scene in particular that really stands out is when Danny, who was the young kid in The Shining, now as an adult in Dr. Sleep, is forced to return to the Overlook Hotel. And there at the Overlook Hotel, he has a conversation with his father, who was Jack Nicholson in The Shining.
Slow night, Mr. Torrance. Not for long, I imagine. You're a whiskey man, are you not?
I was, most of the time. This was your brand, Jack Daniels. I used to see the bottles in our home, our real home before all this. I smelled one once. It smelled like something on fire, which I suppose it was.
I'm afraid you've confused me with someone else. It's Lloyd.
Lloyd.
And it directly mirrors and mimics a scene that takes place in The Shining as well, where Jack Nicholson is speaking to a ghost who's a bartender.
A little slow tonight, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Mr. Torrance. What'll it be?
I'm awfully glad you asked me that, Lloyd.
Clips from Dr. Sleep, the 2019 sequel to the original 1980 blockbuster from Stanley Kubrick, The Shining. You can actually see Dr. Sleep tonight at the Raleigh Road Outdoor Theater in Henderson. Also, plenty of other Halloween classics are showing at drive-ins and independent theaters across the state. We've put some links to our website if you're in the mood for a drive-in. Stateofthings.org. Check it out. There's screenings at drive-ins all across the state. You can catch The Goonies and The Blair Witch Project on a big screen at the drive-in at The Drive at Winston-Salem Fairgrounds. Carolina Theater of Durham doing outdoor screenings in the Durham Arts Council parking lot. Ghostbusters this week. Gremlins next week. So let's get back to this Dr. Sleep, Laura. It uses the same characters in the same setting, same creepy hotel, but, you know, 40 years later, which is kind of interesting, too. Tell us more about this.
You know, I always have to wonder. So it was directed by someone named Mike Flanagan. I don't really know who Mike Flanagan is, and yet at some point in this project, he must have said to himself, I can make a movie as great as Stanley Kubrick. And this is doomed to failure, I would think. I mean, the hubris of tackling a sequel to something that's considered to be a classic seems very daunting to me. I mean, I would never do that.
Well, and yet, I think there's something liberating in the fact that you can't. I mean, you could never make a film that could kind of match The Shining. And so in some ways, I think that's freeing, and I was surprised how interesting I found it. It's not The Shining, and it never will be, but I don't think it tended to be, because it's really developing alongside, apparently, the King novel, which I've not read, these ideas about the legacy of domestic violence and alcoholism and trauma and what happens when you grow up with that. So it's really moving it into different territory, even though it's still wedded to that, you know, masterpiece of cinema.
Well, I guess the difference is whether or not you're going to trade on that or jump off from it. If you're going to use the fact that everybody's seen it and everybody knows it, and you say, yeah, now let's explore these themes, you might have a better chance.
Yeah.
Which may have been what this done. And that all those deep themes, when you talk about some of the deep and dark themes that are reflected in this, what comes to mind immediately for me is Scooby-Doo.
My name is Sam Binder. I'm calling in from Rochester, New York, and I'd like to talk about the Scooby-Doo franchise. We've been, you know, in quarantine for, you know, 6 months now, and it's all felt like being at my grandma's house for just way too long, which, you know, it's a throwback to when I was a little kid and my parents had to work, and so I'd go there and watch Scooby-Doo. And there were the Scooby-Doo movies where they'd meet like Sonny Bono or Don Knotts or Batman, the Addams Family. And they were just really off the wall in terms of what was even happening or like the world that they lived in.
I'll tell you one thing for sure, Scoob. They don't need our help to figure it out.
We're grew-ups.
Yeah. The only time we ever do anything right is when we accidentally plow into the snow ghost because we've accidentally glued our feet to rocket-powered roller skates.
Watching those in the midst of, you know, the spooky season has been kind of my Halloween outlet rather than maybe more traditional fare like the Halloween movies or the Saw movies or whatever.
That's an appreciation for the TV and movie series Scooby-Doo. Let's talk about that, because we're returning kind of this hybrid format, kind of long-form TV shows, taking TV shows like Scooby-Doo. Sometimes it's hard to stretch those into 20 minutes and then to go into the movies is pretty rough. But we'll talk about the concept here. Marsha, let me start with you and how that plays into this whole theme of the variety of reboots that we can look at and you know, reruns.
Well, I grew up with the animated show. That's something I watched as a kid. And, you know, it's about these teenagers and their dog solving these quasi-supernatural mysteries. And I have not seen any of the films. But I will say that, I mean, this is a pretty thin story to hang your hat on. I mean, I don't know how you really develop this into anything other than a kind of farcical fare. But that's okay. I mean, I will say that it's interesting to think about. I don't know how they've done at the box office. I don't even know how many there are. But obviously, this is a cross-genre phenomena, and sometimes it works better in some genres than others. Obviously, horror works really well with a sequel. There are horror film franchises that go on and on and on. As a matter of fact, somebody responded
on one of my social media channels that like Hellraiser 10 was the best of all of them. And I was like, 10?
Right. But okay, here's the case. Isn't this where the fan base and attachment to the characters is everything?
Right. Yes, because how long do you want anything to go on? There are so many, you know, television series where I watch the first season and it's like, okay, I get it. That's enough. You know, I'm not invested in going on any farther. But once you've made your, you know, declared your affection for a world and a series of characters, maybe your desire to see them is insatiable.
We are talking about sequels today on Movies on the Radio, this episode of The State of Things. As always, Laura Boyes, film curator from the North Carolina Museum of Art and the curator of the Movie Diva series at the Carolina Theater in Durham. Marcia Gordon, a film professor at North Carolina State and a scholar at the National Endowment for the Humanities with us. And Laura, you picked another TV series to movie sequel. Let's take a listen to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Sir, may I quote General Order 12 on the approach of any vessel when communications have not been established?
Lieutenant. The Admiral is well aware of the regulations.
Aye, sir.
Is it possible the comm system has failed?
It would explain a great many things.
They're requesting communication, sir.
Let them meet static.
We are aboard the Starship Enterprise from Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. Laura, why is this your favorite?
So the Star Trek television season was not particularly popular. It cost a lot of money to make. The ratings weren't that good. It was cut off after 3 years. But then it gained a new life in syndication, and people really fell in love with the characters. And they made Star Trek the Motion Picture, which was a crashing bore because the people who made it didn't understand that we didn't really care about the whole, you know, space opera part of it. We loved Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock and everybody. So then they decided that there was a better way to do it, and that was to go back to what people did indeed love about the TV series, which was those characters. And they looked back to an episode from the original series, and rather than having one of the TV villains who populated Star Trek, you know, Warren Stevens, Anthony Zerbe, Nehemiah Persoff, they got someone who was a real movie star, Ricardo Montalban, who had been a star in Mexico. He'd been an MGM contract player in the 1950s, and he could command the big screen. So between his huge performance and William Shatner's hamming and Mr. Spock's death scene, it was just a perfect combination.
Marcia?
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is that the first Star Trek was incredibly expensive, and so this second version had a quarter of the budget of the first. So not only were they going back and mining the television shows for ideas, but they were shooting it actually with the television division of Paramount Studios, and it broke box office records that opening weekend. And you know, they were already talking about the third one when the second one was being released, because now they saw the writing on the wall, which is the goal was to release one every 18 months to 2 years. And that's pretty much what they did for a really long time.
I mean, it's fascinating to think about the lesson here. Lessons learned from why it failed. Let's make a second one, but learn a lesson, versus the way in which other sequels often do fail, especially by, say, the third time, which is let's just kind of try to thin out what we did in episode one. That worked. Let's keep doing it, right?
Weak tea.
Weak tea. Well, we're talking about the strongest tea you can possibly have at the noon hour. It's The State of Things with Movies on the Radio, Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon, and our look at sequels, reboots, and the best of number two and number three coming up on The State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Tis the season of undead film franchises. At indie theaters and on cable TV, there's a flood of horror movie reboots and endless movie series. And while some recycle the first film's formula, others do break the mold. I'm here with Laura Boyes, film curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art and the Movie Diva series at the Carolina Theater of Durham. Marcia Gordon is a film professor at NC State and a public scholar at the National Endowment for the Humanities. And listeners from across the state chimed in with their picks for best and worst movie sequels. Well, if you missed the opportunity this month, you can join the show next month. It'll be my last Movies on the Radio before I ride off into the sunset, so we're going to do something a little different. You have an opportunity to guess my favorite movie, or at least the movie I like to talk most about. The winner will be entered into a raffle for a... Now, you don't need any more of that. But the fact is, you can pick what you think is my favorite movie and then tell me why, and we'll run clips from that. You'll probably... I've only seen 10, so it's not going to be that hard to figure out if you know what I've seen. But you can... You chime in, we'll run clips from what you thought it was, and then Marcia and Laura and I will talk about what we think is my favorite film. But... Marcia, let's talk about your favorite film for this series, The Reboots. Let's hear a clip from Aliens.
Ripley.
I don't want to hear about it, Bishop. She's alive. There's still time.
In 19 minutes, this area is going to be a cloud of vapor the size of Nebraska.
Hicks, don't let him leave.
We ain't going anywhere.
See you, Hicks.
Dwayne. It's Dwayne.
Ellen.
Don't be gone long, Alan.
Sigourney Weaver and Bill Paxton starring in Aliens. Marcia, why is this your favorite?
Well, I wouldn't say it's my favorite. I think it's one of the most interesting as a case study of like a perfect sequel in the truest sense of the word. So there's a number of these, but I just recently rewatched Alien, Aliens and Aliens 3. And each one literally picks off from where the other one left off. And so it follows this really wonderful character, Ripley, played by Sigourney Weaver. She's a great female action protagonist. Nobody listens to her, so she constantly experiences the frustration of men ignoring her, of corporate greed overriding what is right and what is wrong. So it has this nice kind of parallel to the real world and fighting this horrible, formidable alien. And so the first one was directed by Ridley Scott. The story was by Dan O'Bannon. And it's a perfect Ridley Scott film, a little goofy, you know, a few scares. And then James Cameron does the second one. And it is, James Cameron is so good at suspense. He's so good at science fiction, all of the special effects. This is one that you're like on the edge of your seat the entire time. And he really likes, you know, these women action heroines. And then David Fincher did the third one, and it was really his first foray into feature filmmaking after doing music videos. And it looks like a Fincher film. It's very sepia, it's very drippy and male focused. And it takes place entirely on a male prison planet. So it's just a really nice example of the way that sequels in the hands of different directors just kind of evolve over time, even though they really stick to the core ideas of the original film.
Well, speaking of sequels, I want to follow up with something I said a little bit earlier. If you want to participate in next month's show and pick my favorite, you can give us a text us at 919-980-5419. You can tweet at us at #SOTMovie or email us at SOT@WNC.org. That's a follow. And by the way, messages about next month's Movies on the Radio 3 comes out next month. All right, so in contrast to the never-ending Star Wars franchise, there are some limited trilogies, like, for instance, The Godfather.
Hi, I'm Jenna Emily Jaffe, calling from Asheville, North Carolina. And I wanted to just talk briefly about The Godfather, which I feel, to me, just the perfect movie trilogy. And adapted from a book, and then there were actually 5 books after. It's just amazing to me, the continuity of the film and the actors. And I think that what stands out to me are the brothers and the relationship with the brothers and the father.
I understand 30,000 men enlisted this morning.
Bunch of saps.
How many saps?
Honey, come on, we don't have to talk about the war.
Hey, Beep, you talk to Carl, right?
The saps, because they risk their lives for strangers.
Oh, that's pop talking.
You're damn right, that's pop talking.
Risk their lives for their country.
Your country ain't your blood, you remember that.
I don't feel that way.
I don't feel that way. Well, if you don't feel like that, why don't you just quit college and go to join the army?
I did. I enlisted in the Marines.
Mikey, why didn't you come to us?
What do you mean?
I mean, Pop had to pull a lot of strings to get your deferment.
I didn't ask for it. I didn't ask for a deferment. I didn't want it.
Come on, knock it off.
But it's so rich and so deep and detailed that I have just watched that trilogy numerous times.
Talking about the Godfather trilogy, which was released between 1972 and 1990, which is my question, Marcia. 18 years, a long time for a trilogy. Francis Ford Coppola, of course. Would we have the patience for that kind of timeline again, do you think?
That's a great question. I think this was such a beloved, the first and the second films were so beloved that people were thrilled to get the opportunity to dive back into this world and see how the characters had evolved and changed over time and how they were going to tell this story. But if you recall, when the third one came out, it was not met with the same critical or audience acclaim either. So, and a lot of that revolved around, and people were very upset about Francis Ford Coppola casting his daughter Sofia Coppola in a role that they said, you know, she was horrible in, and that it kind of ruined the universe of the film. And so this was, I would say, the third one, was the weak link in what was until then like this stellar example of American epic storytelling.
Well, many people felt that the second Godfather was better than the first one. But for me, the ending of the first Godfather with the baptism, cross-cut with all of the murders, it's like, that's a beautiful ending. I really don't need to go any farther than that.
Let's move. We're talking about sequels today on The State of Things. Mostly we've heard from listeners' favorite sequels, but there are some bad ones.
My name is Amy. I'm from Durham, North Carolina. I'm calling about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, all of them. I think I watched them when I was a kid. I don't remember them that clearly. But when the fourth movie came out a few years ago, my friend held a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle watch party. And we all dressed up and watched all three of the old ones in a row in his apartment. And I was kind of shocked by how much I loved the first one. I don't remember it being that witty as a kid. It was witty. It had a great, strong, funny female character. It was full of humor. I just loved it so much. And in the second movie, it's like maybe they changed writers or something. It was totally different. It was like the character of April from the first one, who was so amazing. She was what really shined in that first movie, even more than the turtles themselves. And in the second one, it's like they just ironed her flat, and she was insipid and boring and just such a disappointment. And the third one, I can't even remember. It was probably the same.
Excuse me. Sorry. Aren't you on?
As much as I like to be someone that a girl like you would recognize, I can assure you, you don't know who I am.
You're Baxter Stockman, PhD, graduated from MIT at 15 years old. Your innovations in nanorobotics at TCRI have been truly inspirational for me. I'm so sorry. I'm just like, I'm a nerd.
No, please, geek out, please.
Really?
Yeah. Oh,
thank you.
Yeah.
Actually, though, there's a big difference. I'm a nerd, not a geek. It's the difference between, like, Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter, or TED Talks and
Comic-Con. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
From Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze. You know, talk about that. That's interesting if you think about change of writers. I don't know that we'd know in particular what happened in the writing room, but, you know, Laura, I think about the fact that when you change directors for the Star Trek movies, things got better. But talk about those changes in the staffing and the production staff.
Well,
and how
they're
that affects
trying
the
so very hard to make it exactly the same but different. And sometimes they just choose the wrong element to accentuate. They have a complete misunderstanding about what was so good about what they did before. Although I have to say, I totally endorse having a watch party for all three Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movies. I think that's really an excellent party plan.
Well, and I think also this is a case where, I mean, obviously, movies are made to make money, okay? So that's the reality. So there's no, like, pure this and pure that in the Hollywood system. But this was such a surprise hit when it came out in 1990. It made so much money that clearly it was like, this is part of a bigger franchise of stuff. It is the comic books. It is the merch. It's the television. It's the movies. And so there are many other examples like this. Some do better than others. I mean, I know that the first Austin Powers movie did okay. The second one made four times the box office. They had no idea that they were cooking at this level, but everyone's trying to figure out how to make that extra dollar.
Were there Godfather lunch boxes?
That's a great question. Yeah. I don't know. I have mine was Wonder Woman, so I don't know.
Yeah. Is that a horse head in your lunch? Could we trade? let's hear from another listener who picked a wildly successful trilogy.
My name is Elizabeth Behrens, Liz, and I live in Cary. Number one, I read the books, but also I just like it because, number one, it had the whole trilogy had the movie version had a fantastic cast, as you well know. I think they just developed throughout the whole trilogy, you know. So, but you know, one of my favorite characters, although I can't say that he grew into such a nice character, but Gollum was one of, talk about being torn. He really, really did struggle between good and evil.
Go away! I hate you. Where would you be without me? Ellen, I saved us. It was me. We survived because of me. Master looks after us now. We don't need you. What? Leave now and never come back. No, leave now and never come back.
It uses practically everything that you would want in the sequel, and of course it's because good battles evil. And I think for my generation, which is unusual, because some of my friends are like, "You like all that stuff, Liz?" And I thought, "Oh yeah, that's exciting."
Andy Serkis excited about Lord of the Rings trilogy. By the way, you can join our conversation for next month's movies on the radio. It'll be my final one, and I'm going to ask you to guess my favorite movie. Email us at sot@wnc.org or give us a call or text at 919-980-5419. You're listening to Movies on the Radio on the State of Things. Laura Boys and Marsha Gordon. Lord of the Rings, the same sort of expansive world building as Star Wars, but done really of a piece, right? I mean, they made a serious effort to make sure that they got all that done before everybody grew up, right? I mean, it was real.
And, you know, for me, the Lord of the Rings was so much fighting, so much orc killing and other, you know, epic battles that I can't get enough orc killing.
You know that. Marsha?
She does probably watch it on the weekends and not tell anyone. But I was reading this 2016 story in Variety magazine, the industry trade magazine, about sequels around this time. And it's kind of interesting. In that year, a third of the movies being made were sequels in 2016. I was thinking about that year's version of Lord of the Rings. And yet it was one of only three franchises that was actually making steadily more money each time. So even though there's obviously a great economic benefit to counting on your prior audiences, unless you're really, I think, reaching beyond your niche audience, you're not going to keep expanding your revenues. So again, this is all boils down to economics and the kind of calculus that's being made at the studios about what they can, you know, make money off of.
This is designed to be three. I mean, it was written as three parts. Although you will know that Tolkien did not want this to be episodic. He saw this as one volume and did not want it to be three volumes. And yet, it's three parts. And so that's part of what's going on here. Laura.
And apparently, the Mario Puzo estate also, fought against additional Godfathers coming out after the three because, of course, there's the impulse. How can we make more money off of this?
When I was talking about the book, when the publishers wanted Tolkien to envision it as three volumes, he said, no, I wrote one book.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I think the last summer of 2019, where we had a blockbuster season, I think there was hardly any original content. I think it was all sequels. I mean, and there's always, you know, the James Bond movie to look forward to that, you know, Hollywood is always betting the farm on, basically. And when there's something original these days, it's something that they really make a big deal out of because it's so rare to have, you know, original content, especially in the blockbuster season.
Marcia, you have created original content, and congratulations, because you made a film and it was selected to screen at the Doc NYC. Congratulations.
It's true. Thank you. Yeah, it's called All the Possibilities, and it's about the artist Vernon Pratt, who was Durham-based for many years and taught at Duke University. And I will say one of the most amazing things about film festivals right now is that because they're all online, anybody can buy passes or tickets to them. And so I encourage people to seek out some of the content that's happening at film festivals right now. It's really amazing.
Not anybody can make a film as good as you, but we can all enjoy it at this film festival. And so you can check out links to that at our website as well. Laura Boies, thank you, curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art and the Movie Diva series. Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State, National Humanities Center fellow. Thanks to both of you. See you next month.
Thank you, Frank. Looking forward.
Next month, November 18th, Movies on the Radio. Pick my favorite movie and win a trip to your living room where you've been for the last 9 months. And you can find out more about the show at stateofthings.org, a show that's produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hollow-Mormon, Kaya Finlay, and Stacia Brown. Elikam Dodor is our intern. Jenny Lawson, our technical director. Al Wadarski helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.